Let's talk about Brooklinen sheets. As you know, listening to this podcast and following us on social media, Charlie and I are massive fans of Brooklinen. So much so, we are both repeat customers. We have both gone back multiple times to buy more sheets for our whole family. Because I think it's easy to underestimate just how important sleep is. We can go on and on in these ads about how you spend a third of your life in your sheets, but it really is so much more than that. A good night's sleep helps your mood. It helps your mental health. It helps your ability to handle those challenges life will throw at you. And what is the main factor in getting a good night's sleep? Good bed linen. And Brooklinen really delivers on this. Their mission is to bring five-star quality sheets to everyday life. This is luxury bedding without the ridiculous marked-up luxury price tag. It's because of this that Brooklinen is the fastest-growing bedding brand in the world. And it's easy to see why. You won't sleep on a more comfortable pair of sheets. Mine comes straight in off the line and straight on my bed. Seriously, my Brooklinen sheets are the best, most comfortable sheets I've slept on. And right now, brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer just for our listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use promo code SITE at brooklinen.com. Brooklinen is so sure you'll love your new sheets that they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all their sheets and comforters. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code SITE at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com. Promo code SITE. Brooklinen. They really are the best sheets ever. On September 7, 2015, Corinne McCabe received a disturbing call from her husband at around 2:30 a.m. A voicemail is recorded, and she is shocked to hear what sounded like pain and distressed groaning and growling, followed by the word "stop it" before the message cut off. Her husband was 32-year-old Henry McCabe. His body would turn up 6 miles away from where he was last seen. Despite the suspicious voicemail that he left for both his wife and brother, investigators do not believe there was foul play involved. Hello, this is Insight and I am Ali. Here with me again for the first time in, again, what feels like forever, is Charlie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am doing pretty well. Spring has sprung here, and I'm not a winter person, so I'm really enjoying the warmer weather. Before we start this week's episode, for those not on Facebook, we just want to explain what the hell is going on with our schedule going forward. This year has been a roller coaster ride, both personally and professionally, for both of us. We were working way too hard, and it was affecting both the quality of the content that we were releasing. It was affecting our friendship and our sanity. There were multiple times, and I'm sure I can speak for Charlie here too, but there were multiple times that I hated podcasting and I wanted to quit. But instead, we talked it out. We both released some frustration. We both knew the direction we wanted the podcast to go. More discussion back and forth and time to really dig into those cases that took more than a day or two to research and write. We gave each other the American summer to decide if we wanted to keep going or end Insight. And I think it helped. Going forward, we will be in your ear holes the first 3 Mondays a month. Plan is we'll have 2-hour-ish episodes a month and then a shorter 40, 45 minutes or thereabouts episode. But knowing us, they'll probably be 3-hour-ish episodes. You may have noticed that we brought back the old opening music that we felt was more of what we loved, and we are creating the content that we want to and you all deserve. And I really hope I can speak for both of us, but I feel like we've fallen back in love with what we're doing here.
I really feel like this was a good decision, even though it was hard. We don't like not putting out content. We don't like disappointing our listeners, but we had to do something to make sure we could keep the show going and to make sure we wanted to. And it turns out we both want to.
And dropping back the episodes also gives us more time to dedicate to Patreon and the patrons who help support the show. And we have big plans for that in the coming months. We're bringing back the bonus episodes and we're going to have articles and more interaction with the patrons on Patreon. So go to patreon.com/insightpod to find out how you can register and join in. But with that all out of the way, we'll move on to today's episode. Henry McCabe was a 32-year-old Liberian immigrant, and at the time of his death, he was living in Moundsview, Minnesota. He was quite prominent in his community, and he worked for the Minnesota State Review Department as a state auditor. According to all accounts, he had quite a happy life. He had a good job, a nice house, he'd been married for 11 years, and he had two daughters that were aged 10 and 1. However, recently his life had begun to take a little bit of a downturn. He received a negative review at work, which it sounds like he didn't take very well. There is also a rumour that he and his wife were actually separated at the time of his death. And if not separated, I've also read that they were taking at least some time apart to figure out if they wanted to continue the marriage. But then I've read other reports to say that his wife had said that Henry and her had planned on moving to California. There was also a rumour that he was struggling to pay his bills, at least his rent anyway, because the last rent check had bounced. How true these rumours are, I'm not really sure, but they are out there in several articles about the case. Now, there isn't anything to support the fact that he and his wife had separated. What we do know, though, for certain that at the time of his death, Henry's wife, Corrine, and their two daughters weren't in Minnesota. They were in California visiting the grandparents.
September 6th, 2015, it was a Sunday night, and it was over Labor Day weekend. Henry was at home alone and decided to hang out with his friend, Calvin Johnson, and a relatively new friend who later claimed to be more of an acquaintance, William Kennedy, with the next day being a holiday. I'm assuming he had it off of work since he worked for the state. The three of them hung out for the day and decided later to go to a nightclub. And Allie and I spent so much time trying to figure out the name of this nightclub. It is Pavlitsky's on 65 was the name of it, but it's generally reported that it was called C'est la Vie. And I found a blogger saying that the club was called C'est la Vie, but only on Sunday nights. I'm not really into the club scene, so I don't understand any of that. But under any name, the place has since been closed down. And based on the Yelp reviews that I found from the time Henry would have been there, the place was kind of a dive. But even dive bars have alcohol, and the men were spending the night drinking. From what Calvin and William said later, Henry was drinking heavily, and he was quite intoxicated. They decided to take both his keys and his wallet off of him, which is a move that is later criticized, but I can see both sides of it. Calvin took Henry's wallet because he was already having financial issues, and getting drunk at a nightclub is not cheap. To keep Henry from buying more alcohol, he took the wallet. This strikes people as odd, and I have to admit, I've never taken a wallet off of a friend for any reason, so it does strike me as odd, but I can still see the explanation.
I don't know, maybe Henry was arguing that he was fine, that he wanted to drink more, and this was the only way to stop him from drinking more.
Right, yeah, it's something I've never done, but, you know, I'm not saying it's never done by anyone else. It seems logical to me. William took Henry's keys. Again, he's a drunk friend and you take their keys. I have absolutely taken keys. The issue raised with this, though, is that I'm under the impression that Henry didn't drive himself to the bar. So the only need he had for his keys was to get back into his house when he got dropped off. It's possible, though, that William was worried he was going to lose his keys. Or maybe Henry did drive to the nightclub, or maybe he had driven to William or Calvin's house and they were afraid he was going to try to get back to his car and drive away. I think that's another possibility. So this can be painted as really suspicious for them having done this, or it can be painted as two friends concerned about this guy who is heavily intoxicated. I think there are things that will come later that both raise the suspicion side, but also things that raise the caring friends side. This one's a little hard to parse out. We do know at this point Henry still had his cell phone on him. About 1:40 in the morning, Calvin said that they were leaving the club and William offered to drive Henry home. Now, according to an interview Calvin did with a local Fox News affiliate, he heard William ask Henry for directions to his house. And Henry said to just drop him at the gas station. William protested this a bit, and Henry said, quote, "Brother, just drop me at the gas station. I'm going to be fine. This whole area is my area." So Henry got into William's car and then they drove off. So there are a couple of strange things here. One, Calvin did not give Henry his wallet back before he left. And two, the gas station Henry wanted to be dropped off at was, according to William, the Super America gas station, and it wasn't in the direction of Henry's home. It's been reported that it was in the opposite direction, but I would categorize this more as like not in the right direction. It's not like he took him farther away from his house. Basically, from the nightclub, you would go southeast down one main road to get to Mounds View, which is where Henry lived. They went southwest down a different main road. The Super America gas station is actually only 2 miles from Mounds View, and it's right on the corner of two major roads. So I can see, possibly, that Henry was simply telling William, don't go out of your way, bringing him all the way home. Just drop him at the corner gas station and he'd walk the rest of the way. Now, that's not what I would do with a drunk friend, especially when I thought I needed to take a wallet and keys off of. But it's possible that's the thinking. William didn't know where Henry lived if what Calvin said about him having to ask for directions is true. So William wouldn't know how far the gas station was from Henry's house. He may have thought it was closer. Except, it's going to come out later that this Super America gas station wasn't the station that William actually dropped Henry off at. The one he actually dropped him off at was off that same main road, but a couple miles farther south. And we'll get more into that in a little bit.
Now, something that I would like to know, and it may or may not be relevant to the case, but I would be interested in knowing if this was something that Henry did often, or if this was a kind of one-off event because his wife was out of town and he was feeling down about work and feeling lonely. And why I would like to know this is because if he went out often and drank to this extent, then it wouldn't be so much of a massive deal. But then on the flip side, if this was a one-off time that he just got this drunk because things weren't going the way he wanted in life, then it does add a different twist to the story if we're considering his mental health at the time.
I definitely think that that is relevant, 100%, whether this was something Henry normally did and this was just kind of nothing to him, or if this was something that was out of the norm for him. The other thing I think I would really like to know is how drunk William and Calvin were, because that explains some things as well, such as forgetting to give him back his wallet, or, you know, some people say they purposely didn't give it back, but if they forgot to give him his stuff back, it could have been because they were intoxicated. It would explain why William couldn't remember what gas station he left him at. So those are things I would also want to know.
Because if there's something that Henry did often, maybe he did walk home from a gas station after a night of drinking. He may have known that if he went home, he wouldn't be able to sleep, so he just wanted to get dropped off so he could walk home and try to walk off the alcohol before he went to bed. Another reason why could have been that he was feeling really depressed, and alcohol is a depressant, and he was having a hard time and he wanted to clear his head and walk home doing that at 2 a.m. when you're very intoxicated does seem a bit strange. But then again, when you've had too much to drink, you really aren't thinking too straight anyway. It may have seemed like a good idea at the time. Another reason why he was dropped off, and people have speculated online, is that maybe Henry wanted to, he had planned to meet someone at that particular gas station.
It's interesting how many times we'll do a case and we're like, but they were drinking, so we can't really rule in or out any logical thinking. William left Henry at the gas station, a gas station, and this was the last time anyone ever saw him alive, but it's not the last time that Henry was heard from. Early newspaper reports say Henry made 3 phone calls, but you'll find another one that says 2, and then others will say it's actually just 1 call. And there are so many conflicting reports about who called who and what was said and how long the calls lasted, and even whether the calls were picked up. The problem is that the media reporting on this, which is dependent on police and witness interviews, don't always get the whole picture. So they report a piece that they have, and then when everyone puts the pieces together, it gets muddied with the contradictory reports.
And that's a problem we'll see with the 2 other cases we are covering this month, that it is very reliant on news reports that constantly change within the same news source. And then people add their own ideas and the whole situation becomes fabricated, nothing like what actually happened.
And then there are people like us, podcasters, or, you know, there are bloggers and YouTubers and online commenters, and we're all doing the same thing. We're trying to take these contradictory reports, and I'll be honest, sometimes we as a community will make them worse by making assumptions or drawing conclusions, but most of us are really trying to be as accurate and logical as we can. So we say all this to say that this is our understanding of how the phone calls happened after we have both read various sources, weighed their reliability, and had a little back and forth on this. Henry's wife, Corrine, told police that she received a very strange phone call from Henry at 2:23 a.m. So we're going to say that's about 23 minutes after he was dropped off. Corrine said it sounded like an accidental dial, you know, like a butt dial, and Henry wasn't trying to talk to her. What she heard, though, chilled her to the bone. She would later say in an interview that it sounded like he was outside and that he was walking. At the end of the call, it sounded like maybe he had been injured. He cried out. So obviously, Corrine was very concerned about this, and she didn't know what to do. She was in California. Minnesota's in the middle part of the country, and California's clear on the West Coast. So she tried to call Henry's brother, Tim, who lives in Minnesota and is very close with Henry. So if Henry was in trouble, Tim would have been the one to call. Now, this is where we think a lot of the confusion in this case comes in. There are reports that there is a voicemail of the last 2 minutes of Henry's call to Corrine. But how could there be a voicemail if she answered the phone? Other reports say the voicemail was from when Henry called his brother after having called Corrine, and that the voicemail was actually on the brother's phone. So what it seems like happened to us is that Corrine didn't hang up with Henry in order to call Tim. She either purposely or accidentally, I'm going to go with purposely, did a conference call, like a 3-way call with Tim. Now, Tim, being asleep at 2:30 in the morning, didn't answer, and the call went to his voicemail. And that's why it picked up the last 2 minutes of Henry's call to Corrine. This is the only scenario we can see that all of the stories make sense. The line went dead, and Corrine did try to call Henry back. She got no answer. Again, I'm under the impression the phone went right to voicemail like it was dead, but like I just said, we make assumptions and I may just be assuming that. You know, those of us who rehash these cases, sometimes we make assumptions. Though Tim wasn't awake to get the phone call, it likely wouldn't have changed anything if he had been. The glass half full thing here is that Tim didn't answer because the call went to voicemail and we have a clip of it.
Now, the voicemail's about 2 minutes long. However, you can't hear it in full on the internet. Believe us when we say that we've tried. You can only find it in a clip on in a news report, and that version is only about 20 seconds long. As Charlie said, we're going to do something that we don't normally do, and that's included in here, and you truly get the gist of how truly terrifying and creepy this voicemail is.
It's a voicemail unlike anything you've ever heard before. There are 2 minutes worth of noises, bizarre ones, but very little actual talking. Authorities confirmed the disturbing middle-of-the-night call came from Henry McCabe's cell phone. The tortured grunts suddenly stop. There is silence. Then someone, either Henry or another person, says, "Stop it." The voicemail is in stark contrast to other articulate recordings of McCabe speaking at an event. He's a state auditor.
What is the justification? What is the right thing to do?
The message is one piece of evidence Moundsview police are reviewing.
Now, if you go on online forums, you will find people who insist that they have heard the entire 2 minutes, that they've heard the whole voicemail message. It may have at some point been available and then redacted, but for whatever reason, open investigation, what have you, it's no longer available. I will also put the link to the voicemail in the Facebook group if you want to listen to it again without having to try and find it in this episode, but we would really like a conversation in the group to find out what you all think about it. Now, to me, it's really creepy. It's kind of that low, guttural, groaning, growling sound. It does sound like some kind of animal, and some people have speculated that it's something more paranormal or supernatural, like an alien or Bigfoot. Obviously, we have seen in so many of our other episodes that when it comes to voice recordings or surveillance footage, you find that so many people say so many different things. But can we deduce from what we can hear that he's being attacked by someone? I really don't think so. It would be good if we could hear more so we have more of an idea, but I don't think that you could conclude that he was being attacked from what we can hear.
If every company was like Simple Contacts, I could fire my babysitter. I am so busy between being a mom and working, and Simple Contacts is a game changer for anyone who wears contact lenses. If you wear contact lenses like me, then you know how annoying it is to have to get the prescription year after year. Well, Simple Contacts is changing all that by using technology to make renewing your prescription and buying contacts super simple. Here's how it works. You use your phone or your computer and you take the Simple Contacts vision test in 5 minutes from literally anywhere. I was in my living room, in my pajamas, with my baby crawling around. A real doctor reviews your test in 24 hours, writes you a new prescription, and a fresh supply of your brand of contact lenses is on the way to your door. And if you have an unexpired prescription, just upload a photo of it or give them your doctor's info and order your lenses in minutes at a great price. This isn't a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam, so my babysitters are lucky I keep them around for that, but this is the most convenient way to renew a prescription and reorder your contacts if your vision hasn't changed. I honestly didn't believe it would be as easy as it turned out to be. Simple Contacts offers every brand of lenses, and their prices are unbeatable. Best of all, our listeners get $20 off their first Simple Contacts order. To save $20 on your lenses, just go to simplecontacts.com/insight20 or enter the code insight20, that's insight20, at checkout. Again, check out Simple Contacts and get $20 off by going to simplecontacts.com/insight20 or just enter the code insight20 at checkout. Give it a try and you can thank me later. One of the things that interests me is I think it is possible that the phone call was an accidental dial, and I think we get into it a little bit later, but he may have had his phone in his hand at the time. I also can see perhaps it was a covert dial, that something was happening and Henry was scared and called Corrine so that she would hear that something bad was happening. And that's exactly what she did hear. But like you said, without the full call, and we have this clip from the news and then a description of things that we don't get to hear on the news clip because they don't play the whole thing, we don't know.
And that's the thing. We only know what we know. And it's then up to people to fill in the gaps. And that's where the issues do come in. Now, Kareem would later say that in this phone call to her, Henry would tell her that he was shot. And that could go into what you were saying, Charlie, about him meaning to call her to try to get help. This is obviously what concerned her and why she tried to conference call in Tim. Then at the end of the call, it just goes completely quiet. Henry stops making any groaning sounds. And then a voice just says, "Stop it," before hanging up. A lot of this case would be based around the voice saying, "Stop it." A lot of people will theorize that it was Henry himself saying it. Then a lot of people will say it was someone else saying it. However, because this clip hasn't been released or because it was taken down for whatever reason, we don't know. We don't know even if there was a voice saying stop it. It could have just been something that people have added into the story as time has gone on.
I think that the voice was saying something like stop it only because of who was reporting what it said. It was an ABC News reporter, Avian Tan, was describing the call. And verbatim, what she said was, "Near the end of the voicemail, the sounds suddenly stop and a voice can be heard saying, stop it." And that's the end of the quote. Now, they're not saying if it was Henry or anyone else. Henry could have been saying it to someone else. He could have been saying it to himself to keep himself from freaking out, which he was obviously doing. But I think without having this out there, we don't know. This is what the reporter and ABC News is interpreting those words to say. But we've seen with the JonBenet Ramsey call, the background chatter has been isolated and analyzed. The Brandon Lawson case, which is pretty similar to this one in that there was a call recorded of a man in distress, then the man goes missing, and no one is 100% sure what it says. So we're just kind of going off what we're told it says. So I think it's a something. I don't know if there's some interpretation to it or not.
One thing that growling and moaning sound could be on the phone, it could have been if the phone was damaged. And that's very well could have been because of how Henry was found. But a damaged microphone on a phone can mimic those noises and sounds like an animal sound when in reality it's just a damaged microphone. But again, we don't know because none of this information has been released. So Henry's brother Tim wakes up the following morning. He listened to the voicemail and it would have freaked him out. He tried to contact Henry and there was no answer. Tim immediately contacted the police and he filed a missing persons report with the Moundsview Police Department and the investigation into Henry's disappearance starts. In the first couple of days, there was no activity in his bank account, which is something that is always looked into in the early days of a missing persons investigation. He didn't contact his employer, he didn't contact his wife or his other family members and friends. After the phone calls from and to his phone, the phone was turned off or disconnected in some way, it may have been damaged, and it wasn't turned on after that. It literally seemed as if he had disappeared without a trace. There was no other cell phone activity, the FBI was contacted, and they were heavily involved in this case from the start. The police questioned the friends that were with Henry that night, Calvin Johnson and William Kennedy, and they confirmed the timeline of events. William says he dropped Henry off at the Super America gas station. So, of course, the police retrieve the CCTV footage from this gas station and they review it. The problem is, at no time does William's car or Henry appear in the footage. Now, this immediately throws suspicion upon William. He becomes a prime person of interest in Henry's disappearance because why would you lie about that? Eventually, what happened is that William remembered the location incorrectly. Now, I don't know if William had also been drinking that night. You would hope not considering he was driving, but we don't know for certain. Regardless, even if he wasn't, we are talking about the early hours of the morning and chances are he was just very tired and simply misremembered. The police decided that based on that, they would review the CCTV footage from other gas stations in the area. It would eventually be that William dropped off Henry at the Holiday gas station just off Central Avenue. And there is CCTV footage of William dropping Henry off here. Now, whether William lied about this on purpose or if he genuinely did get confused, to be honest, I'm not sure why William would purposely lie about it, because we know that the police were going to eventually find out when they looked at the CCTV footage and Henry wasn't there. From what I have read and gathered from the story, I genuinely do believe that he just got confused. But what is confusing here is that the two gas stations aren't that close to each other. They're 5 miles apart, which would be the equivalent to a 12-minute drive and in different directions. It's all very strange.
So police looked into Henry's phone records, and the last ping was from the vicinity of Creekview Park at around the time of the call to his wife, which was then confirmed by police to be that 228 call. It's about a 2.5 mile walk, so we're looking at 45, 50 minutes at a normal walking pace, and that's not even taking into account an intoxicated walking pace. The problem here being, if Henry was dropped off at the Holiday gas station at 2 a.m., how did he make a 50-minute walk in 28 minutes? If he was running, he would have had to have run a 10 to 11-minute mile. I mean, he looks like he was in decent enough shape, but that's pretty fast for someone so intoxicated that his friends took his keys and wallet away. And so I have a hard time believing he ran that fast or that he even had the desire to at 2 in the morning after drinking. So we actually have 3 other explanations. First, someone picked him up and drove him to the park or past the park. Second, that the timeline is off. And third, that the cell tower ping wasn't on the closest tower. So let's go ahead and take those one at a time. If he was drunk at a gas station in the general area of where he lived, I mean, broadly speaking, area where he lived, maybe a friend or a neighbor saw him walking and offered him a ride. They haven't come forward. If they did, as far as we know, so that does make it look a little shady. If someone picked him up and it was all above board, why haven't they come forward and said so? The second issue is the timeline. We can't confirm the timeline ourselves. The CCTV footage has not been released, and the times provided of when they left the club and arrived at the gas station, those all come from William and Calvin. The only time I saw confirmed independently was that phone call.
Even if the 2 a.m. drop-off is slightly off by 15 minutes or whatever, it still seems like the timeline here can't quite match up. I think if they released the CCTV footage to the public or the police were more forthcoming with the timestamp that they saw, I think that would answer a lot of the speculation here. And like with so many other cases with the CCTV footage involved, I'm sure the police do have reasons they're not releasing the footage, be it that that has no bearing on what happened to Henry or there's something there they're withholding to assist any current or future investigation. But in knowing that, it would make it more clear exactly what happened. Maybe you could see someone pick up Henry in the footage.
Yeah, and like you said, even if you adjust the timeline a little, it doesn't fully account for this gap of time. So our third issue is that cell tower records are not exact locations. They're not GPS. Thanks to Serial and Undisclosed Podcasts, I know way more about cell tower pings than I ever cared to know, but it's actually coming in handy right now. The tower your call pings isn't always the closest tower to you. Weather or usage or direction, those all affect which tower call pings. We know he was likely within a mile or two of that tower, and certainly not several miles away. But most of the points we're talking about in this episode are no more than 3 to 4 miles from that park. So he could have been a 20-minute walk away from the tower and still his cell phone pinged that tower. Creekview Park is absolutely where Henry would have passed on his way home, whether he walked, ran, or was driven. So it's possibly a combination. If the timeline was off, like you said, by 10, 15 minutes, if Henry decided to jog or he walked briskly, and his call was sent to a tower that was a mile from where he actually was, then this all makes sense. It's a perfect storm to make it seem like he was moving more quickly than he was, than he actually was.
I don't know. The problem with the timeline is, as you said, we're leaning largely on what mainly Williams said and his side of what happened that night. And according to William, that Henry just insisted on being dropped off, and so he did, without his keys. So I'm not sure how he was going to get in his house when he got home, but I'm not sure exactly what happened. And again, without a more definite timestamp, we can't know for sure exactly what happened, whether he walked briskly or he was picked up.
I feel like people are putting a lot of stock in that cell tower ping, and I think cell tower pings are just not reliable enough for us to do that.
And if they released the timestamp, it wouldn't be relied on so heavily because we would have a more definite time.
That's true. You have to wonder, since the investigation, as far as we know, is closed, they haven't released it, which means they don't think it's in the public interest. And I think sometimes they don't want to release things because they don't want it to cause more speculation. But I don't think you could possibly cause more speculation than there is currently about this case.
I think it'd be easier for them just to do it instead of all these rumors that Bigfoot took him or he was murdered by some gang. I think it would put things to bed.
Shortly after the investigation started, there was a $10,000 reward offered by the Minnesota Community Police. Now, this is not the actual police. This is a nonprofit group. They're more like a charity who helps out with community issues. They have also been known to work specifically with the Liberian community of Minnesota. They came forward with a reward for any information that would lead to the discovery of the whereabouts of Henry McCabe. However, this reward was retracted about a month later, stating they had issues with inconsistencies. Now, I mean, you guys shouldn't be surprised listening today. We've pointed out a lot of the inconsistencies, but what they said in their statement about the retracted reward was that it was Henry's wife, Corrine, who was holding up the investigation. They argued that Corrine was deliberately withholding information and she was being misleading with the information that she did share, and they felt the information she had could lead to the location and recovery of her husband. They thought that Corrine had given evidence that indicated Henry was alive and she wasn't sharing it. They even released a recording of a conversation they had with her about this to media outlets, but I've not been able to find it online, and it's not clear that anyone even broadcasted this conversation. So we don't know what this information was, but Corrine's story about this is a little different, or a lot different. She says she actually fired the Minnesota Community Police from working on the case, and that any information she has had, she passed on to the police. And she hired a different agency to assist in the search.
Now, despite what the Minnesota Community Police did believe that Corrine knew, Henry McCabe's body was found on November 2nd, 2015, almost 2 months after he went missing. He was found in Rush Lake by a kayaker, face down in the water. Now, I'm not entirely sure of the state of his decomposition was, but I'm assuming as he would have been in the water for that long, he probably wasn't in the best state. This means that his walk from the Holiday gas station, or drive, to Rush Lake was even longer than we thought, Rush Lake being about 6 miles away from the Holiday gas station he was dropped off at. So we aren't just talking 48 minutes now, we need to add another 10-15 minutes onto that. But as Charlie said, with the cell phone pings, we can't really rely on what the original time frame was anyway. But it's not like we're talking about a Caelan Louder situation here where his body could have floated down a canal or stream. If you look online on Google Maps, you will see that Rush Lake is completely landlocked. So for Henry to be found in the lake, he would have had to have been placed or fell into the lake. We can speculate from that voicemail that Henry died fairly soon after the call was made. And if Henry's body was found in the lake, we can only assume that Henry died in or next to the lake, meaning he walked for at least an hour or was driven there, but we'll get more to that in theories. The New Brighton Police Department released a statement saying that the Ramsay County Medical Examiner's final report showed that Henry died from probable drowning in fresh water. The use of the word probable is very interesting here, as there wasn't a definitive answer. The weird thing is that Henry said to his wife on the phone that he was shot. So it is understandable for his family and friends to expect that he died from a gunshot wound. But that wasn't the case. Henry's body had no outward signs of a struggle or any lacerations or bruises to indicate he was in a fight before his death. And there was definitely no gunshot wounds found, according to the autopsy report anyway, that has been released. And even after the autopsy, Henry's death remained an open case, even though it was determined that his cause of death was drowning, and the police continued their investigation. Okay, so the majority of you listening out there today are women. And being women, I'd say there is a good chance that you'll have breasts and deal with the same issues I do in bra shopping. Having to find bras that match how your breasts are shaped are really hard. And that's why I love Third Love. Third Love design bras not just thinking about sizes, but with the shape of your breasts in mind. And this is what makes them the absolute best. They've just added 24 new sizes, which makes them the industry leader with a total of 70 sizes. I hate going bra shopping, trying to find a bra and the fit isn't right, and the shop assistant is awkwardly trying to help. Third Love is great because you do all of this online. When you visit their website, you take a fit finder quiz. You answer a few simple questions about your perfect fit, and it's all kind of fun. Nothing like bra shopping in a store. In this quiz, it helps you identify not only your perfect bra size, but also the shape and to find the styles that suit you. And that's a wonderful thing. I know that most of the time I'm wearing the wrong size bra, but Third Love, you are sure you're going to find the perfect fit every time. Third Love knows there is a perfect bra for everyone. So right now, they are offering our listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/site now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/site for 15% off today.
So, of course, I don't want to discount what the coroner had said and the medical examiner in the cause of death. And so I can see maybe it is probable drowning. But I read that when he was initially found, they actually couldn't tell even the gender of the body that was found, which would tell me that was pretty advanced decomposition. So I don't know how they can say there were absolutely no injuries. I can see saying there were no signs of injuries like puncture wounds or broken bones. But if he was drowned by someone else, I don't know that they would have seen the bruises from just being held down.
And that's what I thought too. 2 months in the water, there would have been a large amount of decomposition. I get that they can rule out a gunshot, but bruising that would happen in a general fight, I'm not sure after 2 months how they can tell that.
So with that, we'll go ahead and move on to the theories of what happened here. And the first one is the official one, that Henry died according to what the medical examiner found, and that it was an accidental drowning. So let's just say that he did make it to the lake in the amount of time we have for him to make this long walk. Either he walked to the lake to clear his head, possibly he was trying to figure out how to get home. Because I mapped this, because of course I did, and the most obvious path from the gas station he was dropped off at and to his house that passed by that Creekview Park. Now, if he kept going straight from there, he would have come to a point where he had to veer left or veer right. Now, left would have taken him home, and right would have taken him toward Rush Lake. And right would have taken him toward Rush Lake. So it was dark. He was intoxicated. He was perhaps disoriented. Maybe the reason William couldn't remember what gas station he was left at is because that wasn't the gas station he was supposed to leave him at. And really, that this was just one wrong turn. Instead of going left and going home, he went right and ended up going towards the lake.
And for those people who like watching YouTube, John Loudon, he covered this case, and he actually takes the drive from the bar to the gas station to the lake. So you can see how easy it could be in the dark, intoxicated, to make a wrong turn and end up there.
Since it was dark, I could see him having his phone in his hand. I use my phone as a flashlight all of the time. Usually I'm using it to sneak through little kids' rooms while they're asleep, but I use it almost every day. And I've also used navigation while I was on foot because I have no sense of direction. So he may have had his phone out using the flashlight, trying to get his navigation working, and he was fumbling with it and accidentally called Corrine. Or he called her on purpose because something was happening. But in this scenario where it was an accident, he may have called her on purpose just to talk to her because drunk people do that at 2:30 in the morning. So distracted or disoriented, he somehow went off the road to the lake shore. The sounds we hear of growling, it could have been him struggling in the water or in pain because he tripped on something, and that's what made him fall into the lake. Now, my only hesitation with this is in the clip we have heard, there are no splashing sounds. And I think if the call overlapped him going into the lake, we would have heard something splashing sounding. So I wonder if maybe he was just hurt and stumbling around. He dropped or hung up the phone before he went into the water, or maybe even as he went into the water.
It would have been easy for him to, say, trip over something when he was playing with his phone and injure himself, hanging up the phone in the process, got up, still injured, stumbled around and fell into the lake. We don't know how deep that lake is when you first go into it. It could be a very deep lake and he could have been drunk, thrashed around, trying to catch his breath, trying to stand up. He can't stand up and he could have drowned.
And this phone call, I don't feel like it really gives us a lot of clues. It's extremely alarming because he's obviously in distress, but the noises are fairly indecipherable. The news report that reports the stop it voice says that they don't know if it's Henry or someone else. Those growling noises could be a bad connection. Like you said, it could be damage to the microphone. Honestly, it sounds kind of like Chewbacca to me, so it doesn't even sound like anything I can process. Nothing worldly that I can process, just some TV movie thing. So, you know, I don't think it really gives us as many clues as you would hope.
I've also seen suicide speculated with the argument that Henry drowned himself on purpose. Now, I do have strong doubts that this is the case, considering he called Corrine while whatever was going on was going on. I think it would make more sense if he had called her in the first instance to tell her how much he loved her, etc., etc. I also don't think that it makes a lot of sense to suicide the way he was found. It's actually pretty hard to drown yourself. It's not a common way to suicide. It's actually the least common of all suicide methods worldwide, with only 2% of all reported suicides in the United States being by drowning. So while it's not impossible, I don't think it's very likely.
Another theory that you'll see tossed around is that his death was drug-related, and the idea is that he was dropped off at the gas station because he was meeting someone there, namely a drug dealer. Except he didn't have any money since his friend never gave him his wallet back. So the drug dealer got mad and took him in the car and drowned him in a lake. And that makes no sense unless Henry already owed the drug dealer money or had shorted them in some previous deal. I mean, Henry was allegedly having financial issues. It's a big leap from a late rent payment to, oh, he must have shorted drug dealers and they murdered him. I can't make that leap. We'd also have to assume there was footage of Henry arriving at the gas station, and there would have been footage of him getting into a car with someone, willingly or not. And I think that while the police haven't released a lot of evidence, they would have at least said, last seen in a car matching such and such description, so people would be on the lookout for it. Henry was missing for 2 months, so it doesn't make sense that they wouldn't have released that information if it existed. And drowning someone in a lake is pretty conspicuous, and more so than you'd expect a drug dealer to do. Now, there is another side of the drug involvement theory, and that would remove the drug dealers, that Henry was high and experiencing drug-induced psychosis. This is similar to what was theorized in the Jameson family way back in one of our first episodes. The paranoia was high, and Henry's phone call was really just a recording of him experiencing hallucinations. And due to these delusions or hallucinations or whatever he was experiencing, it led him to accidentally drown. They did do a tox screen, and the results have not been made public, so this theory can't really be weighed one way or the other without that information.
And going back to the murder theory, that is something that is more frequently thrown around a lot in this case. But it is theorized that maybe he did get into someone's car, they drove him to the lake, and they murdered him. The problem here is that there really isn't a viable motive here. There doesn't seem to be a reason why someone would take him to that particular lake and then kill him. Again, I'm not saying it's impossible, I'm not saying there is no chance that that could happen, but there really isn't any motive that has come out through interviews with his wife and his friends. What we do know is that he drowned, but how exactly isn't without any certainty. It was just determined that it was a probable freshwater drowning, and I suppose that assumption was based due to the location where he was found, because there is apparently no outward wounds to his body, and I assume that the water was found in his lungs. I think because of the decomposition, it is possible that someone held his head underwater, though, and that's a possibility if we're going to subscribe to this theory. But even if he somehow walked to the lake in the time period allowed, and then he was approached by an unknown assailant, maybe they wanted to rob him and he didn't have anything, so they killed him. It just seems to me that Henry would be an unlikely target because he was a fully grown man. I can understand women who are intoxicated being caught off guard because they are an easier target due to their size and strength, like may have been the case in the Lauren Spearer case. Not saying I understand in that it's okay, because it's definitely not okay, but an intoxicated man being attacked is less common when we're looking at cases like this. It's more often than not an accidental death.
There are people, though, that are suspicious of William Kennedy and if he had a role in the death of Henry McCabe. He was the last person to see him, to be seen with him on the CCTV. And the first question mark comes up when William told the police that he left Henry at the Super America gas station, and then he actually showed them where at that gas station he had left him. So it's not like he just named a wrong gas station. He showed them the wrong gas station. But like Allie said, why would he lie about it? I mean, he still dropped him off. It's not like he's lied about it and they never found out that he dropped him off and it's because he took him away and killed him somewhere. He did drop him off. He said it was just confusion, and maybe the Super America is where Henry wanted to be dropped off and he went to the wrong one. But I'm just not a big fan of him leaving his intoxicated friend at a gas station rather than taking him to his home. I've given intoxicated friends rides home before, and I make sure they not just make it to their house, but through the front door. Now, they're on their own if they sleep on the living room floor, but I get them in their house. I mean, William couldn't have taken Henry to his house unless Henry wanted to go, because according to Calvin, William had to ask Henry for directions. But I would have insisted on getting those directions, so I don't fully understand this.
Honestly, I believe that given the information that we do have, I believe that the only thing William is guilty of here is just being a shitty friend. I don't think that he was involved in Henry's death. I think that on the CCTV footage, there would be footage of him dropping Henry off and Henry walking away.
And Calvin backs up the story that Henry asked to be taken to the gas station. So if William was involved, because this gas station story was some kind of cover-up, then Calvin was also involved. And I understand they didn't give him his wallet or his keys, which is suspicious, but that just makes me really think they were probably drunk too. And you'll see it reported that there are inconsistencies in William's story, but I haven't really found a lot of them. And William has been questioned by police. According to search warrants, they also got his cell phone records and his tower pings. So they could have looked at those and connected them with Henry. I think a lot of William's decisions here can be explained by him being drunk. I think he made poor decisions, but I don't think that means he murdered anybody.
The next theory, though, follows along the idea that he was murdered. And it's one that's come up before in the Brian Schaefer episode, and I do think we touched on it briefly in the Manchester Pusher episode too, and that's the smiley face murderer. And this refers to a collection of unsolved murders and disappearances of mostly college-aged men who go missing or are found murdered after a night out drinking. And where their bodies are found are generally in or close to water, and there is a nearby smiley face graffiti painted. Now, this is more of an urban legend than anything. There are short mockumentaries about the smiley face murders. There's actually one really good one in particular that I'm thinking of that I may link in the Facebook group. But no law enforcement has ever publicly stated that this is an actual serial killer they are looking for. It was a theory that was thought up many years ago by two former detectives, Kevin Gannon and Anthony Duarte. But there is no actual evidence to state that any of these unsolved murders or disappearances are linked beyond them being young males of a certain age in a certain location who disappear or are killed after drinking with friends. There is a great episode of Thinking Sideways podcast that does go into the smiley face murders if you want to know more about it. But as far as Henry McCabe being a victim of the so-called smiley face murderer, he really doesn't fit the victimology here. He was significantly older than the other cases that are linked, and most importantly, there was no smiley face found graffitied nearby. I can see why it is linked based on location and cause of death, but honestly, I don't even think there is a smiley face murderer, let alone Henry being connected to it.
I find that the smiley face murderer is sometimes a catch-all for these cases, even when it doesn't fit. But I've also seen it come up, and I just don't see, even if you believe the theory, this case to me doesn't seem like it fits at all.
And it is thought that the sound that he was making could have been him being waterboarded, but also it's thought that he could have been being tasered. There is a YouTube video out there that shows people being tasered, cops being tasered. And the sound is quite similar to what we hear on the voicemail. Now, that could have immobilized him and allowed someone to throw him in the lake. Henry was a good swimmer, but the effects of a taser may have immobilized him enough to drown, and it wouldn't have left any physical marks on him.
I could definitely see that, especially with decomposition, that any taser burn would be gone at that point. Any skin abrasion like that would be gone. There is another theory about murder, and this one actually gives a motive, but it's kind of a big picture motive. And that's that Henry's death could be linked to the Liberian Civil War, which was actually two civil wars. They ran from 1989 to 2003. But there was a two-year break in there from 97 to 99, so it's usually called the First Civil War and the Second Civil War, but it was largely happening for 14 years. Some think this explains why the FBI was assisting so heavily in the case, though I know they were also analyzing the voicemail, and that may have been a large part of their involvement as well. The FBI has a lot more resources than even the police that, I mean, this area of Minnesota is near the Twin Cities, so they would have had help from the larger city, but still, the FBI has a lot of resources. The civil wars in Liberia led to a large number of Liberians seeking refugee status in the United States. According to the International Institute of Minnesota, there are currently 35,000 Liberians living in the state, and most of them they do live in that Twin City area. The theory here is that something happened in Liberia, either between Henry and someone or Henry's family and someone else, and that this grudge or whatever it was followed him to the United States and he was killed because of it. And this theory came from a leader in the Liberian community in Minnesota, Lavetta Tuba. She is the executive director with the Coalition for Justice in Liberia. Shortly after Henry was found, she told the Star Tribune newspaper that authorities should not rule out that this was linking back to the violence in Liberia. And she said that they would have killed without remorse and that they had done it before. Aside from her urging authorities to consider this angle, I haven't found any evidence to suggest that this happened or that even says which side Henry found himself during the war. I mean, truth be told, there isn't a lot of evidence here aside from that Henry drowned. If there were injuries on his body from someone holding him down, they weren't there anymore. If there were taser injuries, they weren't there anymore. Now, his mother does believe he was murdered. She still lives in Liberia, and she told the Africa paper that she believes her son was killed.
Look, to me, it is possible, but it seems like the timing wouldn't match up here. Someone would have had to have been following Henry around in order to do this, and there is nothing I could find in my research that indicates he was being followed or stalked. It just would seem like too much of a coincidence for someone to have this huge grudge on Henry and just happen to come across him intoxicated at a gas station or a lake in the early hours of the morning. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Now for the most out there theory in this case, and that was that an animal was involved. And not just any animal, but the biggest of all, Bigfoot. Now I know we have been kicked up the butt in the past for both glossing over these kind of theories or for even bringing them up in the first place. But it is mentioned on forums as a potential legitimate theory, so that's why we're bringing it up today. But I'm sorry, I am going to gloss over this theory on this case. The likelihood of something paranormal happening here is almost negative. But if you want to go down that rabbit hole of Bigfoot being involved in Henry's death, there are definitely articles and forums out there who share what they believe is evidence of the sorts. But even true Bigfoot believers don't think that's what happened here. Again, if you look on Google Maps or if you go to John Lorden's video of footage of the lake, there isn't a lot of coverage at Rush Lake. There isn't a lot of forest there, and what do we know about Bigfoot? He likes to hide out. There just isn't that kind of coverage there at Rush Lake for that to happen. But if there was another type of animal involved, you would have to assume there would have been some external evidence of this, but there wasn't. I really don't know what kind of predatory animals there is in suburban Minnesota, especially the kind that would make Henry scared enough to want to go out into the middle of the lake to get away from it.
Yeah, I think if there were animal attacks or an animal got to his body, there would have been evidence on the bone, and none of that was reported.
There is just a lot of speculation, a lot of inconsistencies here. Nothing quite matches up for me. I'm mostly going to believe that Henry did just get into the lake somehow in the timeline, whether he went for a walk to sober up and clear his head, and he ended up falling in and drowning on accident. There is a lot of inconsistencies in that line of events, but that's the one that makes the most sense to me.
I think in this case, I could go either way with murder or accident, but I don't think there's enough here to investigate it as a murder from what we've seen. There's no suspects, there's no motive, there's no evidence that he was murdered, so I don't blame the police at all for not investigating this as murder. I think they investigated so many angles in those 2 months he was missing that by the time he was found, they had a lot of pieces in place already, so they were able to come to a conclusion rather quickly. Some people might think they came to it too quickly, But I think that's discounting the 2 months they spent before he was even found collecting evidence. So I trust their judgment on this. I think it was likely enough an accident. And unless there was more evidence that came up, there's no way to call this one a murder. Thank you for listening. You can find us on Facebook at Insight Podcast, Twitter at Insightful Pod, Instagram at Insight Pod, or email us at insightfulpod@gmail.com. You can also support the show at patreon.com/insightpod. And a special thank you to Chesgrave Music for our new custom theme.